Section 3, Native Americans. An American Story. In October 1867, a Comanche chief named Ten Bears arrived with other Native American leaders and their followers at Medicine Lodge Creek in present-day Kansas to meet with federal treaty makers and army officers. The federal officials wanted them to sign a treaty agreeing to move to confined areas called reservations and to submit to American authority. In return, the government offered them food, housing, instruction in farming, and other assistance. After listening to the treaty makers, Ten Bears spoke against moving to a reservation. "That which you say we must now live on is too small. The Texans have taken away the places where the grass grew the thickest. The white man has the country which we loved, and we only wish to wander on the prairie until we die." In the end, Ten Bears and the other chiefs had little choice but to sign the treaty. The Army's main representative at the council, General William Tecumseh Sherman, told them bluntly that they would have to accept the deal. "You can no more stop this than you can stop the sun or moon. You must submit and do the best you can." Adapted from Tribes of the Southern Plains. Culture of the Plains Indians. For centuries, the Great Plains was home to many Native American nations. Some lived in communities as farmers and hunters, but most were nomads who roamed vast distances, following their main source of food, the buffalo. Despite their differences, the groups of Plains Indians were similar in many ways. They lived in extended family networks and had a close relationship with nature. Plains Indian nations, sometimes numbering several thousand people, were divided into bands consisting of up to 500 people. A governing council headed each band, but most members participated in making decisions. Gender determined the assignment of tasks. Women generally performed domestic tasks, rearing children, cooking, and preparing hides. Men perform tasks such as hunting, trading, and supervising the military life of the band. Most Plains Indians practiced a religion based on a belief in the spiritual power of the natural world. Reading check. Comparing. In what ways were different groups of Plains Indians similar? Cultures under pressure. As ranchers, miners, and farmers moved onto the plains, they deprived Native Americans of their hunting grounds, broke treaties guaranteeing certain lands to the Plains Indians, and often forced them to relocate to new territory. Native Americans resisted by attacking wagon trains, stagecoaches, and ranches. Occasionally, an entire group would go to war against nearby settlers and troops. The first major clash on the plains began in 1862, when the Sioux people in Minnesota launched a major uprising. The Dakota Sioux Uprising. The Dakota Sioux had agreed to live on a small reservation in Minnesota. In exchange for moving to the reservation, the United States government issued annuities, or payments to reservation dwellers, at least once per year. The annuities, however, amounted to only between 5 and 30 cents an acre, and much of that money ended up in the hands of American traders. These traders often made up stories about debts owed to them by the Dakota, and they took the annuities as payments. Congress made things worse for the Dakota in 1862 by delaying annuities. By August, the payments were a month late, and some of the Dakota were starving. Chief Little Crow asked traders to provide his people food on credit. "If they are hungry," trader Andrew Merrick replied, "let them eat grass or their own dung." 2 weeks later, the Dakota rose up in arms, and Merrick was found shot to death with grass stuffed in his mouth. Little Crow reluctantly agreed to lead this uprising. He wanted to wage war against soldiers, not civilians, but he was unable to keep angry Dakota from slaughtering settlers in the area. Hundreds died before troops arrived from St. Paul and put down the uprising. A military tribunal sentenced 307 Dakota to death for taking part in the hostilities. But President Lincoln reviewed the evidence and reduced the number executed to 38. Many others who fled the reservation when the troops arrived became exiles in a region that bore their name, the Dakota Territory. Lakota Sioux defend their territory. Following the Dakota uprising, the Army sent patrols far out onto the northern Great Plains to prevent further trouble among the Sioux there. This action did more to stir up hostilities than to prevent them, for it brought troops into contact with another branch of the Sioux, the nomadic Lakota, who had offered refuge to Native Americans from Minnesota. The Lakota fought hard to keep control of their hunting grounds, which extended from the Black Hills westward to the Bighorn Mountains. They had battled rival groups for this country and did not intend to let settlers have it. Leading them were Chiefs Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. The Army suffered a stunning defeat at the hands of Red Cloud's forces in Wyoming in December 1866. Army troops were operating a fort on the Bozeman Trail, used by prospectors to reach gold mines in Montana. Crazy Horse, a religious leader as well as a war chief, lured the troops into a deadly trap. He tricked the fort's commander into sending Captain William Fetterman and about 80 soldiers out to pursue what they thought was a small raiding party. Hundreds of warriors were waiting in ambush and wiped out the entire detachment. Sand Creek. Fetterman's Massacre, as this battle came to be called, was just one example of the growing hostilities between settlers and Native Americans. Another incident, the Sand Creek Massacre, took place along Sand Creek in eastern Colorado. In the 1860s, tensions began to rise between the Cheyenne and Arapaho peoples and the miners who had flocked to Colorado in search of gold and silver. As the number of settlers increased, bands of Native Americans began raiding wagon trains and stealing cattle and horses from ranches. By the summer of 1864, travelers heading to Denver or the mining camps were no longer safe. Trade had come to a standstill, dozens of ranches had been burned, and an estimated 200 settlers had been killed. The territorial governor, John Evans, ordered the Native Americans to surrender at Fort Lyon, where he said they would be given food and protection. Those who failed to report would be subject to attack. Although several hundred Native Americans surrendered at the fort, many others did not. In November 1864, Chief Black Kettle brought several hundred Cheyenne to the fort, not to surrender, but to negotiate a peace deal. The fort's commander did not have authority to negotiate, and he told Black Kettle to make camp at Sand Creek while he waited for orders. Shortly afterward, Colonel John Chivington of the Colorado Volunteers was ordered to attack the Cheyenne at Sand Creek. When Chivington stopped at Fort Lyon, he was told that the Native Americans at Sand Creek were waiting to negotiate. Chivington replied that since the Cheyenne had been attacking settlers, including women and children, there could be no peace. What actually happened at Sand Creek is unclear. Some witnesses stated afterward that Black Kettle had been flying both an American flag and a white flag of truce, which Chivington ignored. Others reported the American troops fired on the unsuspecting Native Americans, then brutally murdered hundreds of women and children. Still others described a savage battle in which both sides fought ferociously for 2 days. 14 soldiers died. The number of Native Americans reported killed varied from 69 to 600, with some witnesses stating that very few women or children died. General Nelson Miles later called Chivington's attack the foulest and most unjustifiable crime in the annals of America. But a Senate committee investigating the incident decided that Chivington should not be charged. The truth of what really happened remains unknown. Government. A doomed plan for peace. Fetterman's Massacre and the Sand Creek Massacre, along with several other incidents, convinced Congress that something had to be done to end the growing conflict with Native Americans on the Great Plains. In 1867, Congress formed an Indian Peace Commission, which proposed creating two large reservations on the plains, one for the Sioux and another for Southern Plains Indians. Agents from the federal government's Bureau of Indian Affairs would run the reservations. The Army would be given authority to deal with any groups that refused to report or remain there. This plan was doomed to failure. Pressuring Native American leaders into signing treaties, as negotiators had done at Medicine Lodge Creek in 1867, did not ensure that chiefs or their followers would abide by the terms. Those who did move to reservations faced much the same conditions that drove the Dakota Sioux to violence: poverty, despair, and the corrupt practices of American traders. Reading check. Explaining. What proposal did the Indian Peace Commission present to the Plains Indians? The Last Native American Wars. By the 1870s, many Native Americans on the Southern Plains had left the reservations in disgust. They preferred hunting buffalo on the open plains, so they joined others who had also shunned the reservations. Buffalo, however, were rapidly disappearing. Beginning with the gold rush, migrants crossing the plains had killed off thousands of the animals. Following the Civil War, professional buffalo hunters invaded the area, seeking buffalo hides for markets in the east. Other hunters killed merely for sport, leaving carcasses to rot. Then railroad companies hired sharpshooters to kill large numbers of buffalo that were obstructing rail traffic. The Army, determined to force Native Americans onto reservations, encouraged buffalo killing. By 1889, very few of the animals remained. Battle of the Little Bighorn. In 1876, fortune hunters overran the Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota to mine gold in the Black Hills. The Lakota saw no reason why they should abide by a treaty that American settlers were violating, and many left the reservation that spring to hunt near the Bighorn Mountains in southeastern Montana. The government responded by sending an expedition commanded by General Alfred H. Terry. Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer, commander of the 7th Cavalry, was with the expedition. An impulsive officer, Custer underestimated the fighting capabilities of the Lakota and Cheyenne. On June 25, 1876, Custer launched a two-pronged attack in broad daylight on one of the largest groups of Native American warriors ever assembled on the Great Plains. It consisted of about 2,500 Lakota and Cheyenne warriors camped along the Little Bighorn River. The Native American warriors first repulsed a cavalry charge from the south. Then they turned on Custer and a detachment of 210 soldiers and killed them all. One Lakota warrior recalled the scene afterward. The soldiers were piled one on top of another, dead, with here and there an Indian among the soldiers. Horses lay on top of the men and men on top of horses. Newspapers portrayed Custer as the victim of a massacre. The Army stepped up its campaign against the Native Americans. Sitting Bull fled with followers to Canada, but the other Lakota were forced to return to the reservation and give up the Black Hills. Farther west, members of the Nez Perce, led by Chief Joseph, refused to be moved to a smaller reservation in Idaho in 1877. When the Army came to relocate them, they fled their homes and embarked on a flight of more than 1,300 miles. Finally, in October 1877, Chief Joseph surrendered, and his followers were exiled to Oklahoma. His speech summarized the hopelessness of the Native American cause. "Our chiefs are killed. The little children are freezing to death. My people have no blankets, no food. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." Quoted in "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee." Tragedy at Wounded Knee. Native American resistance to federal authority finally came to a tragic end on the Lakota Sioux Reservation in 1890. Defying the orders of the government agent, the Lakota continued to perform the Ghost Dance, a ritual that celebrated a hoped-for day of reckoning when settlers would disappear, the buffalo would return, and Native Americans would reunite with their deceased ancestors. The government agent blamed the latest defiance on Sitting Bull, who had returned to the reservation from Canada, and he sent police to arrest the chief. Sitting Bull's supporters resisted the police, and the chief himself died in an exchange of gunfire. The participants of the Ghost Dance then fled the reservation, and U.S. troops went after them. on December 29, 1890, as troops tried to disarm the Native Americans at Wounded Knee Creek, gunfire broke out. A deadly battle ensued, costing the lives of 25 U.S. soldiers and approximately 200 Lakota men, women, and children. Reading check. Summarizing. What was the outcome of the Battle of the Little Bighorn River? Assimilation. Some Americans had long opposed the treatment of Native Americans. Author Helen Hunt Jackson described the years of broken promises and assaults on Native Americans in her book, A Century of Dishonor, published in 1881. Jackson's descriptions of events such as the massacre at Sand Creek sparked discussions, even in Congress, of better treatment for Native Americans. Some people believed that the situation would improve only if Native Americans could assimilate or be absorbed into the American society as landowners and citizens. That meant breaking up reservations into individual allotments where families could become self-supporting. The policy became law in 1887 when Congress passed the Dawes Act. This act allotted to each head of household 160 acres of reservation land for farming. Single adults received 80 acres, and 40 acres were allotted for children. The land that remained after all members had received allotments would be sold to American settlers, with the proceeds going into a trust for Native Americans. This plan failed to achieve its goals. Some Native Americans succeeded as farmers or ranchers, but many had little training or enthusiasm for either pursuit. Like homesteaders, they often found their allotments too small to be profitable, and so they sold them. Some Native American groups had grown attached to their reservations and hated to see them transformed into homesteads for settlers as well as Native Americans. In the end, the assimilation policy proved a dismal failure. No legislation could provide a satisfactory solution to the Native American issue because there was no entirely satisfactory solution to be had. The Plains Indians were doomed because they were dependent on buffalo for food, clothing, fuel, and shelter. When the herds were wiped out, Native Americans on the plains had no way to sustain their way of life, and few were willing or able to adopt American settlers' lifestyles in place of their traditional cultures. Reading check. Cause and effect. What effect did Helen Hunt Jackson's book, A Century of Dishonor, have? American literature. Gertrude Simmons Bonin, Zitkala Saw, was a talented and educated Native American woman who spent her life fighting against prejudice toward Native American culture and women. Through her contributions in the fields of literature, music, and politics, Bonin aimed at creating understanding between the dominant white and Native American cultures. As a woman of mixed white and Native American ancestry, she embodied the need for the two cultures to live cooperatively. In the following excerpt from her essay, An Indian Teacher Among Indians, she describes a reunion with her mother after being away from home teaching for several years. From An Indian Teacher Among Indians, by Gertrude Simmons Bonin. Mother, why is not your house cemented? Do you have no interest in a more comfortable shelter? You forgot, my child, that I am now old, and I do not work with beads anymore. Your brother, Dawee, too, has lost his position, and we are left without means to buy even a morsel of food, she replied. Dawee was a government clerk in our reservation when I last heard from him. I was surprised upon hearing what my mother said concerning his lack of employment. Seeing the puzzled expression on my face, she continued, Dawee, oh, has he not told you that the great father at Washington sent a white son to take your brother's pen from him? Since then, Dawee has not been able to make use of the education the Eastern school has given him. I found no words with which to answer satisfactorily. I found no reason with which to cool my inflamed feelings. Turning to my mother, I urged her to tell me more about Dawee's trouble, but she only said, Well, my daughter, this village has been these many winters a refuge for white robbers. The Indian cannot complain to the great father in Washington without suffering outrage for it here. My child, there is only one source of justice, and I have been praying steadfastly to the Great Spirit to avenge our wrongs, she said, seeing I did not move my lips. My shattered energy was unable to hold longer any faith, and I cried out desperately, "Mother, don't pray again. The Great Spirit does not care if we live or die." Analyzing literature. 1. Recall and interpret. Why did Bonin's brother lose his job? 2. Evaluate and connect. How does Bonin's mother react to the injustice of the great father in Washington? How does Bonin herself react? Interdisciplinary activity. Drama. In small groups, assume the roles of Bonin, her mother, and her brother, and extend the passage by imagining what might happen when Dewey returns.